You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job has begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkSpotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow, a nut, a tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay, with PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan and start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Hello and welcome to episode 164 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, we welcome Jimmy LaValle from the album Leaf. Jimmy and I met up in Los Angeles to talk about his early days from the 90s in San Diego, being exposed to DIY and screamo, to touring with bands like the Get Up Kids, Piebald. And we also dived into his album Leaf project, how he met Sigur Rós, Sub Pop Records days, and how he's now busy with film scoring. It all makes sense on how each one happened, because he put himself out there and was involved. Jimmy's story is one of constant creativity and making connections. Thank you to all the Patreon supporters out there. You make this podcast happen. Any amount is greatly appreciated as it goes toward the upkeep of the websites, podcast servers, and distribution. If you want to help out, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. This is episode 164 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Jimmy LaValle from the album Leaf. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
San Diego, that's where you were born?
Born and raised.
And so, getting into music, what were some of the first spots that you were seeing music or getting exposed to music early on?
My high school years basically was when I started kind of discovering non-mainstream music, just the underground, kind of underground world. Back then in San Diego, there was Spaces. Che Cafe obviously was one of the most famous spaces, and still exists, actually. And a friend of mine actually just played there a couple weeks ago, which is so I... it's kind of nice to see that it's still alive and going. And then back then too was Tim Mays, who's kind of a like prolific, just mainstay promoter in San Diego. He has a venue called the Casbah, but the Casbah is a bar. So obviously I was, underage, but he also promoted just many events throughout the San Diego, just in different places. There was I specifically remember seeing this concert that's, it was called May Day, and it was at the Starlight Bowl in Balboa Park, and I've never seen or heard of another show ever to happen there.
Wow.
Again. And it's this old, just like, amphitheater outdoor. And it's the first time I saw like 3 Mile Pilot, which was a huge kind of influence for me back in and those days, and just kind of discovering, and it was like a San Diego scene showcase, A Miniature and like Drip Tank and Chinchilla.
Oh, right.
Like all, there's like that era of San Diego, which is like 93, 94 kind of era.
You're still in high school.
Still in high school. I graduated in 96. But throughout that time period too, it seems like there was a bunch of like venues popping up. There was this place called Cafe Chabalaba, which in my mind, I feel like in the time period, I thought these places were just so big or just like, you know, but they're in reality, they were just, you know, little kind of coffee shops and stuff like that. Like there was also shows at Espresso Roma at SDSU, which was also near the old, there was used to be two Off the Records, and Off the Record was kind of like the really kind of the go-to record store, you know, all vinyl and all that kind of stuff. I bought my first record from Off the Record in Hillcrest. They used to have in-stores. I saw Jehu do an in-store there. I saw Unwound do an in-store there. Nirvana did an in-store there.
You saw it?
I didn't see it. I did see Nirvana at the San Diego Sports Arena.
What year?
It was 93.
So you were like a freshman?
It was the In Utero tour.
Wow.
That's when I saw it. Lucy's Fur Coat, and I think somebody else opened for what? I think I want to say it might have been Smashing Pumpkins, but I did see Smashing Pumpkins at the Del Mar Fairgrounds in this around the same time period. But
what's crazy, I just finished reading Serving the Servants, which is Danny Goldberg's book about Nirvana, and it's more of a music business side. And it's got he's talking about these conversations with Kurt where he's literally concerned about what the punk kids will think.
Yeah.
And we were talking, you know, just a little bit earlier, just sort of like that mentality. Like, I feel like he was still this giant artist, but he still was like, well, what are the punk kids going to think?
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
How did that start then? What was appealing about that scene or just that ethic that connected you versus just throwing the radio on?
I feel like it was like an onion, really, because it was like
you couldn't find it all
first. Yeah, you couldn't find it all, and I felt like my first introduction to that world was Fugazi, and then from Fugazi it just kind of like I had a girlfriend in high school who was obsessed with Fugazi, and you would see that sticker in their logo like everywhere all the time, you know. It was like that sticker,
right?
Like everybody had that thing, and that kind of peeled off. It was just like Fugazi, and I remember the first record I bought was In on the Killtaker. Like my first actual vinyl that I bought myself was In on the Killtaker, and I think from there I'm not sure how it happened, but like the layers of the onion just kept being peeled, and I would just discover more things, find more things, meet friends, and discover things from friends. This was the mid 90s or early 90s, and there was no internet, there was no anything. It was just literally record store, word of mouth, friends, shows, going to a show and having no idea what you were going to see.
Do you miss that?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I used to book shows at this place called Soul Kitchen in East County. And my old band actually is that my old band that I had with Gabe Serbian from the Locust, we were like 15.
Was it Swing Kids?
This pre that.
Wow.
It was this band called Steel Tree. Terrible, terrible band. And it was my first kind of real band, you know. It was like the first time I played bass and first time I like wrote songs and stuff like that. And we were into Native Nod and like Moss Icon and like bands like that.
We would have been friends.
Yeah. and like that, like whole, like kind of like, you know, mono talking, you know, also like Still Life, which was around too that time period. But our music didn't really reflect that. Our singer kind of did, but it was more like, you know, that was around the time of like Kerplunk, Green Day, Kerplunk. And that was like, you know, before the kind of, and around the time period that Dookie was just about to come out too. So there was a lot of like that kind of, that era of things being kind of pushed. But that band was really bad. The point of this little tidbit story is the fact that we played a show with Blink. We're now Blink 182, and back then it was on the way you could be paid for shows was on a tally, door tally,
right?
Basis, a dollar.
It still,
you
know, happens.
Like whoever you say, oh, who are you here to see? Dude, you get a mark, and that's your dollar. And Blink was really mad because we had brought out more people than they did, and it's just kind of a funny story like that. you know, there's a
that they were mad too. Like, yeah. I'm sorry,
or just like, hey, you know, I don't know, because we played. There's four bands. We played third. They played fourth. it was also like our record release too. That we, you know,
you had a lot going for you.
Yeah,
come on.
It was like, we had two. We recorded these two songs or four songs.
It's a hometown show.
Yeah.
I
for
love
Blink,
that.
It was a hometown show too, because
right.
they're from.
Oh, yeah. right.
Yeah, so
I love that.
Yeah,
so that was like mid '90s.
It was mid '90s. It was '94, '94 or '95, I think. But.
Did you know that? I mean, San Diego's a big city. I'm from a super small town, so yeah. like you, I couldn't. No, I was mostly regional bands. Right. Like, did you still feel that? Did you feel connected? Like, did it feel that you were, when you started reading the magazines or starting to go to shows or seeing the distros, and did you start to feel like, oh, wow, everybody's kind of coming through here, or we've got something going on?
I don't think I could put that together. I think it was just kind of like I was in the experience and it was happening, and I didn't think, you know.
You didn't know anything else.
I didn't know anything else, and I didn't feel like particularly lucky, like, oh my God, all these bands are coming here and I get to see them. I kind of just like, I don't know what they would come, and I'd be like, oh cool, Unwound's coming. That's amazing. I'm going to go see them, you know, something like that. And, yeah. and, or bands coming down from, you know, like Carp and, you know, a lot of like Northwest bands that would come down and come through. And also, so that was kind of like my high school era. And in my senior year, is when I kind of met and discovered the quote unquote, like, San Diego hardcore scene. So my sophomore year or my junior year is when I think is when Swing Kids started, and Swing Kids, we used to play at this place called Soul Kitchen that I booked, and we would play shows with them, and we kind of started as like slowly cross, and Justin obviously was kind of like he was a super big influential piece of that scene, of that puzzle. And predating him was Aaron Montang, who was singer for Antioch Arrow, and Antioch Arrow started, and Gravity Records started, and all that kind of stuff happened, and that was like really
that's huge
and huge for San Diego, you know, like Heroin, the band Heroin, which Aaron played drums for, and that was when the haircut started and the clothes and the high water pants and like the look, you know, was like all of that kind of originated back then, and we all just like just ate it up like candy, you know, like everybody just started like cutting their haircuts, and we were called Spock Rockers and like all this kind of stuff, you know.
You guys
high water
that
pants
term.
And like, yeah, we hated the term, or I think we started to embrace it too. There's photos. Actually, Justin just sent me a because we used to go to Olin Mills, which was like a photo, and like we would take like these, all these funny photos with like the, you know, the proper backdrop,
right,
the library books or the like,
yeah, yeah,
you know, all that kind of stuff, and we have these series of photos with all of us as a crew. We would just go down and take these photos, and it's kind of cool actually, because it was before obviously iPhones, and you could just like snap a photo. It's like we'd go and we'd get these like professional photos taken,
yeah,
and like have them in like a, you know, physical form and in a photo album or up on the wall in our hallway of our house or something like that.
That's,
you know?
Cool.
And so it was kind of a cool thing that used to happen back then. And I got a photo from that time period with my haircut. And it's just kind of funny. JP sent it to me not too long ago. But anyway, so I discovered that, like, I remember seeing bands like that time period. I never saw Antioch Arrow, but there was a lot of house shows happening. It was like Clickitati Katawi, Swing Kids, Unbroken, and that whole, there's bands like Julia, these like kind of like smaller bands that never kind of didn't really get that far out of San Diego, but I think for a time period they did, as far as word of mouth at least, like maybe not touring, but word of mouth definitely spread. And like I felt like there was this band called Guyver One, and Guyver One and the Locusts kind of started around the same time period, and I remember seeing them at Che Cafe and stuff like that. And also they had this house in Golden Hill, which is kind of a notorious house for the San Diego history. It's called Golden Hill House, or the Avocado 500 Club is what it was called. It's on 24th and E, and there was a lot of shows that used to happen in that living room upstairs. And my senior year, I kind of met all those people. I spent my junior year watching all of these bands from afar and kind of like, you know, idolizing or looking up to them.
And were you playing at the time?
I was also playing. Gabe and I had a band together it was Steel Tree, and then we turned into a band called Jedi Mind Trick. Gabe was really, really into Star Wars. I'm sure he still is. But and so we had this band called Jedi Mind Trick, and we started getting a little more traction in San Diego and started playing these shows with like Swing Kids, and
not just watching.
Yeah, not just watching. We started like playing with these bands. There was also this warehouse called 14th and C, and it was like Crash Worship. It was a guy from Crash Worship that ran that place, and this guy Skyler is really cool and just kind of embraced us and took our band on and would put us on a lot of bills that he would do at his warehouse. So we'd play with like their Mob Pilot before I knew them, and just like that was kind of how we started to like started to blend with these things. And you know, and then my senior year, the guitar player for Guyver One, I don't know, met all those guys. They were looking for a new guitarist, and my best friend in high school and I started playing guitar for Guyver One. His name was Corey. And around the same time, I think that, because we were like, we were 17, the guys in the band were, they were all about 2-3 years older than us. And so we were like this new crop of kind of like, I don't know, I mean, I'll say I was a badass guitar player then. And that's kind of like where they were like, oh, like those guys are like, these guys are super talented. They're super badass. They're such, they're kids, you know, like this is rad. And, so I was asked to join Locust on keyboards. So I was the Locust's first keyboard player. And so at the same time I was playing, and the Locust had just done like a personnel change. The two, they used to have two singers, Dylan from Struggle. And then this guy, Dave, who was kind of like the lower voice, and they used to do shows with like, we used to do shows with like Man is the Bastard and Bastard Noise and all this, like that kind of world. And there was a lot of influence as far as like the singing style of that, like kind of like high screaming and low juxtaposition, like, you know, like the low rumble. Those two guys quit. And so Locust became a three piece and I filled it out as a fourth and keyboard player. So for a time period, I was just doing both Guyver and Locust. And then it started to get a little tricky, and we would do longer house shows, and it started to get a little tricky as far as like, I think it was just egos, with the singer of the Guyver One and Justin. They were roommates, and they kind of, you know, there's a lot of just a lot of like underground competition going on.
Yeah.
There.
Who's going to get on the show?
You're just like, who's cooler? Or I don't, just like dumb stuff, you know, like really
how high your
like
pants are.
Thing. Yeah, totally. Yeah. it's probably not too far off, but at any rate, I guess backtracking just slightly was like, I felt like I came up in this world and I was introduced to this kind of cool clubs, like hipster world. And, you know, my hair was the certain way, my pants, my clothes, my whatever. And it was just like, felt like I was just like too cool for school. Right. Spring break of my senior year was my first tour. And it was Guyver One, and I remember asking my parents, because we were offered to play this show, the Michigan Fest in Detroit. And I remember asking my parents, like, oh, can I do it? And like, I don't know, I'm a father now, and I couldn't imagine like letting my son like hop in a van with eight dudes, like
go to Michigan, where,
yeah, and like a man, and just drive to Michigan and back in a week, you know.
And they were
like,
cool.
And they were cool. And they let me do it. And it's also like a loft. So there's eight of us in a van. So it was like one bench, two front seats, and a loft. So it was like constantly three people in a loft. Like,
wow.
It was awesome. It was super
fun. Of course it was.
Yeah. But I remember that tour being the most like kind of like eye-opening experience for me, because it was the first time I left California without my parents. I used to take a lot of road trips and stuff like that,
By yourself,
stuff like that, but by myself without my parents, with like a crew of friends. Nobody was over 20, and we had these shows set up, and it was the first kind of my first exposure of like, I remember playing I think we actually played at Eric from Christy Front Drive's house on that tour
in Colorado.
It would have been Boulder.
Put in Boulder, yeah.
Yeah. And just like picking up the pieces along the way and doing all these house shows, you know, like I remember meeting a really strong crew of hardcore kids in Lincoln, Nebraska, and playing house shows there, just like playing all these things. And the thing was, is like getting out of my stuck up, too cool for school San Diego immediate scene and being exposed to all these people that kind of wore their hearts on their sleeves and the Midwest, like just culture, and like also like the Michigan Fest and like all of those people that were just like seeing bands that were, I mean, we like they were the they just were that, they were like emo, you know, like that was like, yeah, know, as we don't want to say the word, but really, but it's like they were like the legit, like, you know, they would be playing shows and playing and like crying on the, like the singer's crying and like everybody's bummed and stuff. I don't know. It was just this kind of funny, like, whoa, this is insane, but also like such like vulnerability and honesty behind it at the same time. That it was just like, wait a minute.
Euphoria.
Yeah. It's like, wait a minute. Like, here I am, this like stuck up 17-year-old, like think I'm too cool for school kind of kid. Me being exposed to this world of people that are just really open and really honest and really heartfelt and really warm and really caring and really genuine. And it was like, this is amazing. Like this scene is something I want to be a part of. This is incredible. And we had that somewhat in our own thing, but it was a lot of like snobbery between us and just like, you know, stuff like that. But that was the tour that I met Christopher Sprague, who was at a band called Constantine Sincati, and met him. They played the Detroit Fest. I met him that, and we kind of all like had this like,
Michigan Fest or Detroit Fest. It was two different.
Michigan Fest, but it was out.
Was it called Detroit?
It was called the Detroit Fest. There was also a house.
What year was that?
That would have been 96. Yeah, they hadn't.
I'm trying to remember because I'm seeing the flyer right now, and I just remember like those were stacked lineups.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back at those things, it was like, and it was these just empty like VFW halls kind of like things with like two stages or no stage, and it was just or on the floor. I remember I've seen so many photos of those shows, and it's like if there was a stage, most bands opted to play on the floor anyhow.
Right.
It was cool. And the people I met during that time definitely were just, it was the kind of thing where it's just like, they're open, honest, cool people. And it's like, man, this is just like, I felt like it was like a personality change for me, something that was just really profound, like for me to see that kind of like attitude and not feel so kind of bottled up.
Work together.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm doing this. What are you doing?
Right. And fast forward to the spring or to the summer after that, after I graduated high school, within 2 or 3 days later, I went on a full U.S. tour, 6 weeks with Jenny Piccolo, Locust, and same kind of thing, playing house shows all over the place, meeting friends, playing with this band called Resin. What was his name? Jason. I forget what his name was, but those guys were really, they're from Rapid City. And then we were like, that was the thing, like Rapid City, South Dakota. Like,
how'd you get into this?
Something exists there? Like, how did you even end up there? And I have a friend, still a good friend of mine, who's from Rapid City that I met on that tour. He lives in New York. He's a photographer. And it's like, I'm still friends with him to this day. You know, I still have a lot of friends from that era that are just like, we could not see each other for, you know, almost a decade. And you're still like, kind of like, just all of those, that time period of playing house shows, playing basements, playing VFW halls, playing makeshift art spaces, DIY spaces, then continuing on, you know, playing these stacked bills, like 5-6 bands, and, you know, like things that I could never even deal with these days, you know.
Yeah. Like, what are the set times now?
Yeah, totally. just the looseness and just like not caring, and then also like continuing and like staying, sleeping on people's floors, like sleeping on the house, staying up with like local kids that you met that day, like listening to records and discovering new music, and just like talking about bands and talking about this and talking about the scene, talking about politics, talking about you know, I don't know, like back then was also like an animal rights thing.
Right.
Just like huge, just a lot of like a lot of different stuff that just was just really connecting, you know, with a lot of that kind of community, and then creating friendships, creating pen pals, like writing letters back and forth and you know, things like that. So that kind of like exposure into different communities across the states, like knowing that there was a community just like us in Rapid City, or just like us in like Mississauga, Canada. I remember this guy Gordon, who was just like, I can't remember what he was, but also all those festivals that you would play, you would also meet like the local like distros and
exactly
like,
those distros, and they had their zines, and you open that up and you're like, oh, that's happening in Maine,
right? Exactly, yeah. Cerberus Shoal was from Maine.
Right.
And that was a band too. You're like, what? You're like, they're from Portland, Maine. I was like, and that band was really, really awesome, prolific. I think they're like a 12-piece or 8-piece or something like that too. which was unheard of back then too.
Growing up in Vermont, it would be Montreal. We'd hear from them what was going on in Canada, and then they would. It felt like there was like a, the horse was riding. Like the information was slower to get to places, but when it did, it seemed to have an impact.
Yeah,
that I don't know if you could quantify.
Right.
Like one issue of Maximum Rock and Roll
right.
at that one punk place. Yeah. I don't know how many kids picked that up.
Yeah. Or Heart Attack.
Yeah.
Which was like, that was my, the West. Well, I guess Maximum Rock and Roll was, where were they from? Was it Chicago?
I don't remember actually.
From? I mean, I remember Kim McClard and Ebullition and Heart Attack and that whole, he had this whole world.
But even the regional ones of like, no, this is the one to get for this because they know Florida or they know.
Totally. Yeah.
And that discovery part, I mean, your brain, that first tour must, and then especially that summer on the 6-week one, I mean, you're a sponge. Yeah. It doesn't, everything's coming
everything. In. I think everything for the next 3 years of that time period for me was, I was a sponge. It was just, everything was just, you know. I went to Europe for the first time in 97, you know, like that was my first tour.
With the Locust?
With the Locust. We did shows with Final Exit and Refused, which, you know, like, played in Umeå, Sweden, and then also discovered a world of people with our haircuts. It was kind of funny. They were like super influenced by the San Diego scene,
you
know, like all of our style and stuff. And that was a huge tour for me too. Just the people I met and all, just that whole thing. Vic Simba,
I love Vic.
Yeah. She booked that tour for us. Like we flew, landed in London. She picked us up at the airport. We stayed at her dad's house in Leeds, played our first show in Leeds and she drove us the entire tour. She was at Victory, right?
She was at Revelation forever. She just left.
I know. Yeah.
Like a year ago or maybe 6 months ago.
I get all those labels confused. Victory, Revelation and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Wasn't my scene, but
really cool. I mean, you got the crash course.
Yeah. Yeah. That was how.
What was it feeling like? Did it feel like it was going somewhere? Did you think at that moment, yes, you don't know now, like you knew now, but like, I'm going to do this. Like, I want to do X.
I did. I mean, I didn't think it was possible, I guess. And when I first went to Europe, it was like, it was the same kind of thing. And also playing with like, that was where I first like discovered squats, you know, like just, we would play in a lot of houses that were just squatted and like these huge spaces. And also Europe, they just cook these massive meals and everybody's fed and everybody's happy and everywhere. Like, it's just such a rad community.
Right.
Like to discover in Europe. Above the level of the States. And the States are really always warm too, but there was like there still is an added level of warmth and just generosity and hospitality in Europe that existed. And then the talent of bands too, and like their sound was a little bit different too because they're European, but there was a lot of bands that were kind of, you know, along the same lines of doing the same kind of music, but just like their sound was just that much different or like that much tighter or like the tone of their amps or, you know, stuff like that, where you would just kind of like grab on to a lot of things and just being, and it was just discovery of like seeing a really good band that you never heard of. You didn't hear their record. You didn't know what they sounded like. You would just see it right there in front of you, standing on the floor in front of you, you know. I think 9 times out of 10, never being able to hear vocals because everybody's just got their amps.
They got 2 lamps too loud.
Everybody's just, you know, and it was awesome. It was just really awesome.
It's not to say now isn't awesome, because the way to be able to connect with people and talk and, you know, be able to connect by the internet. But I love that you're at that show and you're not, you don't have your phone. Like, you're in the moment. You're there. There's a photo I have of a show of I was at, and every face is looking at the lead singer.
Yeah.
And I don't know. My dad was a teacher. He taught. You need to look at someone when we talk to him. That was important. I feel like you were in the moment.
Yes. And that, like, I'm sorry to do that, but like I literally just got like tagged by, you know, Jesse Keeler from, he was in DFA.
No.
From Above, 1979. And
I know the band. I don't remember him.
He was in Mastercraft. where he does that. But basically, he just tagged me in this photo of an old show from, I know you know Sean Scallon.
Yes.
Remember him? The old school photographer.
Yes.
Yeah. Man, where is it? There it is. So this is old photo. I think it was a show in Constantine Sincati. And then, yeah, he just tagged me. He's like, photobomb and pick two.
I think he tagged me
right
in
there.
This.
I'm right.
Wow.
Terrible haircut. Terrible. Like, I don't even know. I have no idea. But like, that was, you know, and this band, this is the kind of thing. I like, look at that. You can see it like right there. Like, oh.
Yeah, they're losing their minds.
And losing their minds, you know. And I remember Joe, he was such a performer, like the singer for Constantine. And like, you know, it was just, and Ian was such a, like all of these guys, like when they played a show, you were just like, whoa. Like, I've never seen a band with like that much emotion and that much like just letting it go and feeling it that much. Almost to a point where you kind of question, you're like, well, that's a little, maybe too much. But you're like, no, they're like, they're legit. Like, it's like legitimately being felt in a way.
I saw this band called Frail from Philadelphia.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. The kid that got grounded for playing the show in Burlington, he like talked about it. He's like, I'm being grounded when I get back, and I wasn't supposed to do this tour. But then it was like the most epic, you know, thing.
Right. Yeah.
And people still talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I feel like you're right. Like,
that time period is like, that's a very real time period right there. Like, that's like the, that's that time period, that moment in
time. But we had it. We didn't have the internet, but right. We maybe had it. We maybe dialed up. We maybe had dial up, or we might have had.
I didn't dial up until 99, and it was AOL or Net Zero or something like
that. Prodigy then, or something like that. But the connection of finding something like that, or the being at the, finding those people in a physical place, I think had a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And versus an email.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Or an Instagram friend.
Yeah.
No offense to any of that stuff. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
The weight of...
the phone call.
Yeah, the phone call.
Yeah.
Talking to someone, hearing their voice.
Hey, what's going on? I'm coming through on, you know, looks like we can, like, book a show around this time period. Like, what, can you do something? Oh, yeah, I'll get back to you or something like that. And then, like, or writing a letter, all that kind of stuff. You
know? The waiting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was okay.
Yeah, totally. You didn't need an immediate response, you know, like when you get a text, it's like, you almost like feel like, oh, I got a good, I don't know, respond to this person or whatever it is, or an email, oh, we need to let you know. Or like, you know, it was just like, oh, we're just waiting to hear back, you know.
But it's, I think that's an interesting special time that you were in, that I think you were learning about the DIY. I call it pre-bleed American a little bit, because also
Jimmy World
reference. Yeah, right? Yeah. Just because the shit went to hell.
Yeah.
And before that, it was sort of this time when things weren't as fast.
Yeah.
And maybe there was more time to contemplate, or more time to think or sit with someone. And I feel like that was it.
Right.
From that other day after, it was all different.
And the other thing that's interesting about this is, like, so, you know, during that time period, I went through Crimson Curse. I started playing with Swing Kids, and we did, like, you know, all these kinds of, you know, similar things and shows like that. But then Christopher from Constantine Zincati moved out to San Diego. We'd started Crimson Curse together, and he was my roommate, and we were, like, really just, like, the best of friends back then. And we started a band called Tristezza, and another guy, Jimmy Lehner, was in a band called Bev Clone. He was from Saginaw. Bev Clone also was another band that was playing in the same circuit, Constantine's Bev Clone, like that, just Midwest scene. Mm-hmm. He moved out too. And so then we started this band, Tristezza. And the same ethic of calling around and just booking your own shows and just being like, all right, let's go on tour. Okay, cool. And then you kind of collected your list of all the people that you knew in your notebook or whatever it was, called everybody. Booked yourself a tour, got shows, went out. Like, if certain shows weren't happening, you're like, oh, whatever, we'll just make something happen, you know? And then, you know, or you would just drive overnight and like pull into a Walmart parking lot in the morning and like fall asleep on the grass in the shade or something. Like, you know, a lot of, like, it's a photo of us. There was it was actually Piebald, Jay June, Tristezza, I want to say the Glory record too. We were all on this tour together.
Great tour.
Yeah. We were all on this tour together. There's a photo of us all crashed out on on a lawn outside of a parking lot.
Wow.
You know, like just sleeping because we'd all, I don't know.
But that's cool though, because the being able to have those experiences together, but also different types of music.
Yeah.
Which you guys were...
Well, that was the thing that was... So that's kind of what I was getting into. Yeah, I was kind of getting into the fact that, like, so Tristezza, like, we were not like any of those bands. We were not at all. We went on a tour, but we knew a lot of those people, like, from the Michigan world. Yeah. And from just the hardcore world. You know, just like those fests. Like, I remember there was an Ohio fest, there was a Michigan fest, there was a fest in Philly, there was a fest, you know, all over the place. And I remember we did this one tour. We ended up playing in Memphis at this town and this venue called Barristers. And we played with the band called the Get Up Kids. And that was the first. And we met them and we had hit it off. And super good friends. And not anything musically similar by any means.
Yeah.
You know.
Especially that year.
Yeah. And they just like said, hey, you should come out and do some shows with us. Like, just continue on the tour with us.
Wow.
And so then we just went out with them for a long time. And also, that was like down to like Houston. And like, and they were, Doghouse was like the shit.
Yeah.
And they were like blowing up. And like, we kind of got put in front of a lot of these people because Get Up Kids kind of took us out and took us under their wing. And obviously, we were a different style of music. We were like, you know, arpeggiated guitar, instrumental, dreamy, mellow, you know. We were not pop or that scene.
Yeah.
But the same thing, like Jimmy Eat World were good friends of ours too. So we'd play shows with them in both Phoenix and San Diego before I think it was just around when Clarity came out. And I don't think they had fully blown. I mean, Clarity blew them up.
A little bit in our scene, but they got dropped. So. Yeah.
But then it was like the next record, I think.
Yeah, Bleed.
They got bigger.
Yeah. But that time, too, it was that they were doing those shows.
Yeah, they were doing shows, same thing. And, like, we did a lot of shows with them. We did shows with Glory Record. We did shows, like, Austin was, like, a really big...
Why did it work?
I don't know. I think it was just a sense of community and friends. I think that's really what it came down to. Because, I mean, to be honest, I'm not at all a fan of that music or those bands, really. And I wasn't then. It was just, like, about the, like... camaraderie and like the friendship and like kind of like you can put that aside. You're like, oh, you know, I'm not really.
But
like,
you were really, probably great to hang out with.
Exactly. Yeah, we were just fun. Like we like were. That's, like,
but
it was
they
the
want
thing.
Someone. Yeah. Oh, you're cool. We like your music. Yeah. I just look. There wasn't this package of you needed it to be the Get Up Kids light, or you needed to be a poor man's Glory Record. Like,
right. Yeah.
No, come out with us. We're gonna dig it. And that's when you go to a show and you don't know what's gonna happen, and you do hear that.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a more. Openness. I felt that, oh cool, that band, like I didn't know what Frail sounded like before. It was just a word,
right?
And then I'm like, oh wow, they sound like this. That
there
blew
was
my mind
about that word too, because you would know Frail like,
a little bit.
What is that band?
You never know.
Yeah.
But it's tough. You're right, that one's a little probably bad example, but I think that's an interesting piece where you were in these harder bands, punk bands, oh it's San Diego, and then you shift and say I want to make this type of music. What was the urge to make that type of instrumental arpeggio sort of stuff?
So for me, I was always, so around that same time period is kind of when I discovered the Chicago scene. And that was a scene that Chicago and Louisville. So like
Initial Rodin, Records,
Rachel's, June of 44, Tortoise, obviously, and kind of everything that trickles down from Tortoise and all their projects. And
I can see where this is going.
Yeah. And so I kind of like discovered all of that. At the same time as also listening to like Crossed Out and Rorschach and, you know, like Manus the Bastard and like Shotmaker, there's like Maximilian Kolbe and like Hoover,
right?
So there was kind of like you could see like the different,
you had a Jekyll and Hyde a little bit,
but also like there's all these bands in the across the middle. There was such a juxtaposition of like the Rachels to like Crossed Out, and you could kind of create this whole arc of bands that kind of just fit all the way like evenly through the middle of like, oh, this band's this mellow, and then a little bit harder, and then this is like the extreme or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much music like that, and it was good. It was all really good, and like I was a fan of it all, really. I remember that Shotmaker record was one of my favorite records. It was a Shotmaker Maximilian Kolbe split too, which was amazing. I don't even remember where those bands were from. There was a Hoover Lincoln record that split. That was Two-Sided Coin, I think was what it was called. Mm-hmm. That record, like, blew. There was all this, all of this music that I was discovering. And at the same time, I mean, I discovered Angel Hair a lot earlier, but then Angel Hair turned into VSS, which was a little bit more, just a slightly more accessible, you know? Mm-hmm. They were still like really heavy. And that was also the first band I saw with their own light show, which I thought was really cool. and it was just Sonny stepping on, like, I think probably power strips.
Right.
But like also like Andy from VSS used, he had a Juno 60, and it was like kind of the basis of their whole sound. And he would switch back and forth between the Juno 60 and the bass. This I've totally gone off.
No, but this is getting to the,
yeah,
I think that's the, like, I've got way into instrumental music. Like, yeah. I loved Tristezza. Like, I loved Blackheart Procession, right. Like Gloria record.
Right.
Started having me dive into different things, yeah. Of like, wow, this could be heavy in its,
yeah,
in its other, in another way.
Yeah. And I guess, well, so to go back to like how I started, I guess, making mellow music, was even when I was in Crimson Curse, Locust and all that stuff, I had a 4-track and I would just sit and make my own mellow stuff. I would put a microphone out when it was raining and record that, and then like write and just play and record something over, you know, so I was always kind of making like mellow, mm-hmm, stuff. And when Christopher and I lived together, we also started discovering Nick Drake. Nick Drake and Red House Painters, those two stand out in my memory of something that kind of like shifted our style of making music.
Right.
And the easiest way is like we wrote 4 songs when we first started Tristezza, and they were in drop D. and then from then on, we had this extremely weird tuning that we used, that I still use today, that, you know, can be dropped. It's a couple strings dropped here or there, but basically it kind of stemmed from discovering that Nick Drake never played in standard tuning. Mark Kozlik, who's in Red House Painters, never played in standard tuning. So we'd learned all these kinds of like different tunings and alternate things, and also like just like putting your fingers in certain places and following the trajectory of the tuning of those strings kind of created this like new thing. And that's where we were like, whoa, this is cool. And that's how we did, you know, we played our first show in our house, in our living room with Joan of Arc.
Nice.
Tim was a good friend. And
I just interviewed Tim recently.
I was wondering if he, like, I was wondering if he had Tim, because I saw, yeah, him, Mike, and yeah. But anyhow, just that whole like this, that also discovering bands like that, like Joan of Arc, they were doing kind of, right, really cool, like different, you know, they weren't the Get Up Kids. They weren't like Jimmy Eat Worlds, or they weren't like, you know, the things that were, there was just this whole other circuit of like indie, smaller bands playing in basements and playing in houses that were,
right,
like, making really cool, interesting music. And that kind of was like,
and a whole different group of people.
Yeah, that too. Yeah,
like look different, like,
yeah,
and had different zines.
Right. Totally. But also like Midwest, and they still like wore their hearts on their sleeves, and they were still like really open, they were still super vulnerable, they were super honest, warm, awesome people to be around, you know. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I could go through like
that's really
cities
cool,
by city,
though,
and just like finding,
but
all
I
of these.
I love that you're saying the cities. Like, yeah. I haven't had a conversation. Like, there really was these other flavors. Like, you're right. The, yeah, Chicago thing. Like, I all of a sudden I see a different color.
Yeah.
Or
Chicago,
like, New York.
Like, I embraced like the first time I went too, because then it was like Martin from Los Crudos, and like that's where we first stayed, and we had that experience in Reckless Records, and like playing like some warehouses there, and like, you know, being involved in that scene with like Fireside Bowl and Melee and God, I could forget a lot of the other bands' names back then. But then also a new era of bands from Chicago that I had a really big connection with was like, you know, like 90 Day Men, and who's Rob, I'm still friends with, Brian too. I mean, I still like remember those guys.
Wow.
And we did a split together when I was in Go Go Go, you know, like there's just like this whole, I don't know, there's just whole there's always these amazing communities within each city that kind of like represent that city to me in a way, like of just like the people.
And know? Then supportive.
Yeah, and supportive.
Of saying, oh,
yeah,
this is your new thing? Cool. Yeah. Play this show.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we'll play with
it. It doesn't,
yeah,
need to be chugga chugga hardcore. It doesn't right. need to be whatever it
I remember is. Crimson Curse, we played at the Michigan Fest, and also Tristezza did. Like, basically Crimson Curse, those guys flew out, which was also like a kind of a crazy thing, like a mind-blowing thing. I think it was also right after JP had done Jerry Springer.
What did he go on again as? What did he do?
So he went on actually for Jerry Springer. He they just concocted this story. My ex-girlfriend was actually involved in it too. She was on it. JP and Alicia were a couple in real life. They also ran 3-1-G together and stuff like that. And they basically concocted this like love triangle story, or but turned into another, like everybody just cheating on each other with under the same roof, basically. Scott Bibin was involved too. I don't know if you know Scott Bibin.
No.
He did Blood Link Records.
Right.
In Philly. And
he put out the Frail thing.
Yeah.
He put out Frail. Okay. Yeah. Wow.
There's a lot of stuff, rad stuff on Blood
Link.
Yeah. But yeah, like there was this whole like just kind of love
triangle. And it was all concocted. Thing.
It was all fake.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, of course, I mean, TV's fake, but
yeah. But it was like along the lines. But they got this. They got the flight out. They got hotels. They couldn't see each other. It was this whole deal. Anyways, I think it was the same time period that we did do that Michigan show. So it was Tristezza played, and then Crimson Curse guys came out, and we also played a Crimson Curse. So one night we did Tristezza. The next night we did Crimson Curse. Same thing. We went to the Fireside Bowl. We played a Tristezza show. The next night we did a Crimson Curse show.
Wow.
So it was like the totally, and because Christopher and I were both Tristezza and Crimson Curse, and it was this like juxtaposition of like kind of our old worlds and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. It was really cool.
What did it feel like looking out? Like, was it the same kids?
It was all the same kids too. Yeah. And they were all. Yeah, I mean, it was a thing. It was like the same kid. Everybody was just open, accepting, like, fans, music
right.
fans, just fans of music, you know, fans of shows, fans of live things happening right in front of you. Yeah, I don't know. And it was I mean, it wasn't like nowadays you go to see a show and it's all on a sound system. It's all on a this. There's like a, you know, there's a stage or there's some kind of separation or some kind of whatever. But even in rooms that had those stages and that kind of separation, there's still a different feel of it. You know, it's like kids all over the stage and like everybody was invited up to just like gather around, or they would play on the floor and like, you know, would barely use a sound system. No, I don't need a mic, you know, don't mic my amp, I'll just turn up, you know, stuff like that. So
well, it's great that it was accepted, you know, that change, where they could have been, you know, the Dylan moment where it was like Judas, you know, Heretic, like, but no, you were able to transition into something that you loved and it's still connected. So I love that. I mean, the first two Tristezza records for me were How I Fell Asleep in New York when I first moved there.
That's cool. Yeah.
Because
Spine and Sensory and Dream Signals or the seven. Okay, cool.
Like those were like How I Fell Asleep, because it wasn't that I fell asleep. It's just, it was so, obviously I lived in a shitty apartment and crazy neighbors and like, but to be able to, have that, I feel like I didn't think I could remember instrumental music because you always think of it as classical. There's and you're forced,
I still know people that are like, I don't know how you write instrumental music. Like they're just so torn. They're like so connected to their lyric and like the structure, you know?
But now that it's like, you listen to it enough, you see the loops, you see the, where this is connected or what that note
does. I've always written in a verse, chorus, bridge, chorus.
It still feels
structure.
Like that.
Like I always write like that.
Yeah.
It's instrumental. There might not be actual words, but I'm always, that's my structure. Like pretty much to this day, I still do that, you know? Still the same thing. It's just that a melody, the vocal is a different, is an instrument and it's a different melody or something. You know?
And then did it feel like doing the Tristezza stuff, did it feel like the open again? Like, oh wow, I've got this whole, like you said, you're seeing the Red House Painters or you're seeing those other ways to write.
Yeah.
It must have just been, okay, now we're going to go in this world.
Yeah. It definitely to me felt, I felt like, you know, when I was in the Locust and when I was in Guyver and when I was in Crimson Curse and Swing Kids and all of that hardcore stuff, I still have a, look, this is like my first tattoo on that summer tour. I got this in the basement, you know.
Of Locust, course you did.
Yeah, on the Locust tour, so the Locust inside my lip. and also I was 18 and told it was fade after 5 years. You know, here I am, 41, and still alive and kicking. But anyhow, that time period was, I was a teenager. I was like, I was just a sponge. I was discovering this whole world.
Right.
I was like, I'd play shows and my fingers would be bloody from like, you know, beating the shit out of my guitar when I was playing and like throwing myself and stage diving and jumping off bass drums and, you know, playing shows naked and just doing all of these things that were just like, you know, a teenager. Like, I'm just, oh, this, I'm a this is amazing, you know? And then I felt like, okay, cool, I did that. And I kind of then started to discover music that really spoke to me, and like creating music that really spoke to me and kind of represented me as a person and what I wanted to do. So that was a kind of a, yeah, a nice, like, kind of just fulfilling moment to just start creating
that music you could that do.
Yeah,
it wasn't that you needed to rely on the hardcore band that made the money. Right. I know, money in quotes, but like
money and no quotes.
Zero quotes.
zero
money, zero quotes. But just that idea that it wasn't relying on, I need to go do that one record or that one song. Like, I can move on and do this.
Yeah.
And it's this other world.
Yeah.
And I think the community part, I love that. You I could still call have friends the same today. Numbers
yeah.
for two different bands.
Yeah, I still have friends from that world, from the same, from like our hardcore days, that when I come through on tour, those are the guys I call, the people I
and
call.
And they're going to come out.
And they're going to come out. Yeah, we're still friends, you know? It's like, it's great. It's great.
And then you were, when did Album Leaf, was that, that was during Tristezza too?
So I started, Album Leaf kind of was born because... Tristezza was like my main band. Tristezza was like after all that hardcore, the hardcore world, Tristezza was my main band. And obviously I play more than just guitar. And during that time, so I was making my own music on 4-track. And a guy actually, a really big Album Leaf fan who's become kind of a friend, through the years, actually found my first tape that I released in 98. And it's fine. You know, it's not great. But it's cool. I'm
right.
Just like, oh, and it's all guitar based. And it was basically because when I was in Tristezza, everything that I would write for Tristezza that, I don't know, maybe didn't get used or something like that, or any ideas that I would come up with that didn't get used kind of became Album Leaf stuff. And also the biggest piece of the puzzle of how Album Leaf kind of came to be really goes back to me playing in Go 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 Earhart, which I played drums for Go 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 Earhart. And the way that band operated, and I also learned a lot from those two guys, Mike Vermillion and Ashish Vyas, Hash, who he's now plays bass for Thievery Corporation. But back then, those two guys, I can't remember how much older Mike was, but I want to say he's probably 10 years older than me. And Hash was, he's probably 6 years older or something like that. But those guys were from a completely different scene in San Diego. They were from just a completely different scene. Like, they were not a part of the hard, they were kind of outside looking into the hardcore world, but they had their own thing. The music that they created was really kind of like soul influenced, funk influenced, jam influenced, influenced by like Wire and The Fall. And
yeah, that's a different, you know, scene.
It's a totally different scene, right? And that is also how he's one of my favorite records is Plastic Ono Band, John Lennon, his first solo record. It's one of my favorite records. Mike was the person who played me. I mean, before that, I knew, of course, you knew all the Beatles, you know,
right,
all that kind of stuff. But, you know, unless you kind of pay attention,
exactly,
and keep going, you don't really think about diving into the solo, you know.
No.
So there was a whole era of music that I was just exposed to from Mike and Hash, and those guys just really, really, I feel like I just need to like thank them for the entirety of my life of just what they exposed me to back in those days, because I feel like they got me out of a very narrow window of music that I had discovered, you know, because turns out, like, you know, of course John Lennon was massive, but those records kind of went unnoticed, and those were the kind of records that, like, it's kind of equivalent to, like, you know, what we were doing at that time period, like bands like Wire and, you know, The Fall and those bands, Joy Division, you know, The Cure, I don't know, like, obviously they became massive, but, like, they started in this small little circuit, you know, of doing things, you know. And so it was kind of nice to be exposed to this whole world of music that was just beyond the kind of, like, I don't want to call it superficial, but just kind of like what was cool to be listening to in the moment, you know? And then they just exposed me to this whole world of...
Here's this other thing going on.
Yeah, this whole other thing, you know?
That's so
cool. First time, like, really listening to, like, the Stooges or, like, listening to...
But someone's has to sit you down and do it.
Yeah, because you don't... I mean, back then, you didn't discover those things. Like, and still, actually, like, I have this... this guy that works with me sometimes, he's 23, 24, and, like, the stuff that he does not know blows my mind. I'm just like, wow. He came up in, like, the whole digital world, you know? Like, he was 3 years old when I started touring, and it's just kind of, like, insane, like, what happened and, like, what he was not exposed to and what he didn't discover, even though, like, there's so much discovery to be had now.
Right.
But you still have, it's different. I feel like you don't catch things because... There's an oversharing of things, you know?
There's a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot
so
to do.
Much.
And also that, not saying it has to be physical,
right?
Because there was mixtapes that I couldn't see anything. I was still listening to music. Oh, what was that? Ah, I don't remember what it was. I never wrote it down. But there's this overload of, like, I needed to see something to have a connection to it. And I think you sitting with those guys and them playing you those records and maybe letting you look through stuff and just being like, holy shit.
Yeah. It was like when I first, like, heard, like, Ike and Tina records, you know, like just this whole, like, kind of world of music that was obviously very important to current music, you know.
And then to Album Leaf, it seemed like it was permeating into that.
So basically the reason why Album Leaf started was because that band, Go Go Gerhardt, we would just practice, and basically everything was recorded straight to tape. Practices were just mic'd up and recorded, and then furthermore edited, and that's how songs were written. Like, it was basically live jams, and we would just jam and jam and jam, and that was, like, songs. That's how songs started. After practice, I would sit around and I would hang out with Mike listening to music or whatever. He also had a Rhodes piano. And so I was like, what's that thing? And then basically, you know, that's when I first discovered the Rhodes. And since everything was always mic'd up, when I would be noodling and playing around on the Rhodes, he was recording me.
Wow.
And that became my first record. And it's just basically him spontaneously tracking and recording me, and being, and him and me, like, kind of laughing, or, you know, just, oh, this is cool. And he'd be like, I tracked that, I recorded that. And me discovering things as I was playing too, like, I would just kind of, like, sit down and, like, just make spontaneous changes, but still playing parts back and forth. So I was kind of, like, inadvertently making a song, not really knowing it. And then it'd be like, oh, cool. And then I'd go back and, like, track strings, like a string machine on it. Or I'd
wow.
And, like, then, oh, the drums are set up, so let me just put drums on it. And, like, and that kind of became my first Album Leaf record. And then in, I think it was 2000, must have been 2000, after Spine and Sensory, an online distro company called InSound.
Right.
It was, like, basically kind of the
first. That was a big deal.
It was a big deal. That was the first of, oh, I can go on the internet and order a record, buy it via credit card or whatever it is,
and
put in my
up.
Address, and it shows up in my house. You know, like, this is insane, you know?
That's insane.
So that was, like, what InSound was. They were, like, the kind of the first of that. And InSound started doing this thing called the Tour Support Series, where they would just, like, basically the bands would go and make their own recordings and, you know, do the recording themselves, pay for it, however, whatever, what have you. You know, just, like, make the songs, give those songs to InSound. InSound would then press a CD. They'd press, like, I think 1,000, and they would give you 500. And then they'd keep the other and sell them on the site. And that was that 500 they gave to you as tour support. So it was like Tour Support Series. So you had this, like, thing
to
sell that would, you know, generate income that you didn't have to pay for. And then there was a long series of that, that they had done. And throughout that, they decided to start a label, called Tiger Style. And so Tristezza had done a Tour Support, release, and we kind of developed this really good friendship with Ari, the owner, founder of InSound. And Tiger Style came around. They kind of, like, they came out and they're like, hey, like, we want to put out the next Tristezza record. Great. And also we want to put out Album Leaf too. Like, we like your first record. Like, let's see what you can do. So basically, like, that was the first time that I got, like, kind of like some support behind me and realized that I had two different projects that I could kind of do. And they also gave me, like, a budget in advance. So I bought my computer, you know, I bought a mixer, I bought a mic, and just
figured it out.
Kind of, like, figured it out. Yeah. Just figured it out how to do it. And then my second record came out, One Day I'll Be on Time, which is basically kind of my first like realized actual like, here I am making a solo record. You know, the first record was kind of like a improv kind of weird thing, but the second one was like my actual record. That record then fell in the hands of Sigur Rós in at a shop in Iceland. They then invited me to open their tour in 2001, and then kind of from there, the kind of the success and popularity of album started to grow.
How did they find it?
Just record shop.
That's amazing.
They basically told me that like they were at the store. I think it was Yonsei or George. But I think it was Yonsei. But they basically, the guy at the record shop said, hey, this is a cool record. You should check it out. It was a CD. And then like they went back to their studio, put it on, listened to it because they were looking for support bands. And then the moment.
Who was that record store guy?
I know. Yeah. I have no idea.
But like, how did he, like, I'm love
imagining,
that.
I know the record store in Iceland. It has to be that, like that one little shop. And I mean, yeah, as we were like saying earlier, like you, unless you were in it, you can't really explain it. And I don't think anyone will ever understand it. If you
we knew it before the internet. Yeah. We lived in that world before it.
Yeah.
That's hard to, even my sister, who's just a couple years older, missed a little bit. Like right. It was just too old. Like her husband, like I have to fix, you know, the TV or I need to like the technology stuff. Yeah. Like there's some like sweet spot.
Right.
With like, didn't have it. Now we're in it and we know how to use it. And yeah. I guess generations after us knew how to market themselves even better.
Yeah. I remember, I mean, Tristezza played a show in the Middle East upstairs, which I guess you were in Boston, so you're familiar with Middle East. Yeah. So, which Mahmoud, who's my current booking agent, like, and I've worked with forever, booked Middle East, Mahmoud Sheikh. It's funny too. I've worked with that guy for like 20 years. It's crazy. But anyhow,
welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, totally. So we booked this show and there was this band that played too, wanted to open for us. And Tristezza, like we'd hit Boston so many times. We were like doing great. We're selling out Middle East upstairs. Like we sold out the previous time. We did it again. We sold it out. Middle East upstairs, which is like 150 people. I don't know.
But still,
like, it feels like, oh Middle my God, East. Everybody's there. And they're like, yeah, you know, they like it's great.
Still 150 people.
Right. Totally. anyhow, this band from New York wanted to play as well, so they to open they did like direct support or like middle slot, you know, and they only got paid, you know, 100 some whatever X amount of dollars, and that band was Interpol. And a week later, Turn on the Bright Lights came out and boom. And I remember like we had sold out, we got paid the most we ever got paid for a show. I think it was like $1,000 or something like that. Like it was like this,
yeah,
you know, we're like, oh my God, this is so cool. But then to fast forward maybe 10 years, I actually ended up playing in a meeting Sam Fogarino and playing in a band with him. We had this band together called Magnetic Morning for a moment. It was I, Sam, Adam Franklin from Swerve Driver, and these two other guys. And Adam I'd met, it was kind of another like kind of weird small like weird world where I toured with the band that Adam was playing guitar for in Europe. And then met Adam. And it's kind of funny because Sam remembers that show, an opening for us, playing that show, getting the extra money. Like it's just like
that's cool. You remembered,
thing. Yeah. And then also Sam has a hardcore background because he's about 10 years older, I think, than the rest of the band. And he came up in Florida in like hardcore scene in Florida.
What years?
Probably would have been '90s, early '90s.
Wow.
And so that was kind of like a nice thing because I felt like
Morning Again. And
like, yeah, I'm not sure. I can't remember.
I'm sure
his band names.
I probably there's a bunch of those. Yeah. Wow, was he in those bands?
Like, he was in bands back when.
Really,
in Florida, like in hardcore. And I remember that, like, because to me, there was still like I still kind of had like a sense of I want to say like I was probably all jealousy really when I think about it. But like bands are just like that. Interpol did nothing, put out a record, boom, they blew up, right? It's like there's no sense of paying dues. There's no floors right. being slept on. There's no like, you know, community being built. There's no like, it's just everything kind of being handed to
lightning
you.
In a bottle.
Yeah, totally. And I remember meeting Sam and thinking like, well, at least Sam had that in him. You know, he paid his dues. He did the time. He did the stuff, you know, so that's okay. That's cool. And I love that record actually too. That record I think is great.
I remember getting the EP, this like 3-song thing from right. Matador
before
and being like, oh shit.
Yeah. Like this is something. You know? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Turn On the Bright Lights, I still listen to that record. I think it's really great.
That's cool.
But it did take me a long time to even myself to like let go of that mentality and like let in certain music, like, and be let myself actually like it and not be like such a hater of things, you know. In the last 10 years, I've become a lot more lighter, you know, but I did go through a time period where I was,
or they didn't have to be that route. It yeah. could have been another way.
Yeah.
Or there's ways to pay your dues other way. I right. feel the same way.
Yeah, totally.
With Album Leaf, I think too, from the Cigaros moment and like having that tour and having more people pay attention, was that must have been an interest. I mean, yes, people were paying attention with Tristezza. There was stuff happening, but yeah. like that's another click of the dial.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I made In a Safe Place, it was after touring with Cigaros in 2003. I did two tours, one solo opening for them in Europe, and then I couldn't afford to bring anybody out for that tour. So then basically from that tour, Ori and Carrie and Maria started playing with me live while I would open for them in Europe. You know, Carrie would come out and play a couple songs, and Ori would play drums, mm-hmm. and Ori would play violin, and it was this cool kind of thing. And so I kind of felt like I had like all of a sudden a different incarnation or a different lineup and a different sound and a different feel from these people playing. And then when we went back to the States, the rest of my band at the time like came out and did that tour. But also like Carrie would still come out and play, and Maria would still come out and play, and Ori would. So it was kind of like this mm-hmm. this mix. And at the end of that tour, they basically said like, oh, you should come out to Iceland, you know, sometime, like come out to our studio, make a record, why not, you know. And I was just like thinking like, oh, that's awesome, but I couldn't imagine going to like Iceland. It seems so just mysterious and magical and almost like it didn't exist back
right.
then, you know. It's just like, what, how do you even get there, like does a plane, I, you know, just silly thoughts, you know. It's 2003 or 2001, and so I went out and I made that record, and during the course of making that record, I was going to release it on Tiger Style, but then I ended up getting and actually Dave Brown was managing me at that time, and we reached out to Sub Pop, because Tony K at Sub Pop used to also have this band or this label in LA. When he lived in LA, he had a label called Waxploitation.
Right.
And he put out a band called Strictly Ballroom.
Yes.
Which was Jimmy Tamborello from Postal Service. And then I also, Tristezza and Strictly Ballroom created this really big friendship back in late 90s, I guess. Jimmy Hay from Strictly Ballroom started playing bass for Tristezza. I started playing in Strictly Ballroom, keyboards for them, and we were kind of this like kind of family, like LA San Diego connect family. Like we played Whiskey A Go Go. We met at a KEXP, no, not KEXP, I always get that
KCRW
no not KCRW the KXLU.
Oh, KXLU.
KXLU showcase.
Oh, sacrilege. How do we forget KXLU? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
KXLU gods.
I always, because they're all K something, and you're like, oh, God, I mix them all up, you know. And a lot of stuff happened. A lot of the LA kind of that world of Strictly Ballroom and Paul Fisher, too.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, KXLU. Like
started at KXLU. Jimmy Tamborello had a show there, and my friend Mitch still has a show there, and I actually did it like a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, went down there. It was kind of cool to relive it. And Tristezza played there, so Tristezza played a live, you know, show on KXLU, and then also brought us onto. And it's the same sense. That was the same sense of like we were in San Diego, we didn't have a connection to LA. We went up, we played at KXLU, and then boom, all of a sudden, like. We were playing at the Smell in, you know, with Strictly Ballroom. We met Strictly Ballroom and blown away. They had two drummers. It was crazy. Like, it was just like, and they were making this really beautiful music, and it was like really kind of like really beautiful. And then they would just like
blast into this like huge thing. And then, you know, they're a really cool band, and I started playing piano with them. And that was a like a mix there. And so basically that long, also during that time, I played with like Seam and with like Modest Mouse and
so they would just call
before
you
they were blow, before they were blown up.
They would just call and say, hey, we need a keyboard player. Hey, we need so this. So
during that time, Jimmy Hay and I became really close friends. And Jimmy Hay was in L.A. and I was in San Diego. And we would just like drive back and forth. He would come down and hang out with all of us. I would come up here and hang out with them, you know, spend like days up here. And we just hang out. We were just all like really tight friends. And so that was kind of how it was, yeah.
That's like, so cool. Show,
like, you know, Jimmy Hay did that, did Tristezza's second tour with, he was the bass player for the second tour.
That's so cool. And then that, so Sub Pop found you through Jimmy.
So basically I had met Tony during that time period too. So Tony and I were good friends, before he was at Sub Pop. And then, he moved to Seattle to go to Sub Pop. And then when we would come through Tristezza, we would actually stay at Tony's house and sleep on his floor and hang out with him. And then, when I was making that record In a Safe Place, I sent him what I was doing and the story behind it. And they were like, oh, I want to put it out. So then that's how Sub Pop, that's how that
that's amazing. Started.
Because Tony was an old friend.
Funny how that works out.
Yeah, totally.
Unsolicited demos.
That record then, being on Sub Pop and putting out that record, obviously propelled me into a much bigger, you know, just put way more visibility on me. And, because I remember like touring with Sigur Rós, 2003, doing that second tour, playing at Radio City Music Hall, playing like all of these massive places, and then going out about a month later on my own and thinking like, okay, cool, I'm gonna go off that momentum. Was like still like nothing's clicking there, you know.
I gotta work, still got work to do,
you know. And then so being on Sub Pop definitely helped that, having that promotion and that press machine and that, you know.
I mean, I feel like the Into the Blue Again was the, I feel like the, a lot of people, I don't know your Spotify numbers, but I feel like those songs connected deeper, and having that happen on that record versus your first or second was, it's almost like they gave you time to cultivate.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely kind of, I guess it started to feel more of like falling into a sound.
Right.
With In a Safe Place, I was still kind of discovering like what I was wanting to do, and, you know, like just kind of making songs that just were happening, discovering electronics, discovering programming, discovering like a lot of, you know. And I feel like Into the Blue Again was when I kind of fell into what I felt like was my, you know, my sound had not really, I mean, like my sense of melody, my sense of atmosphere, my sense of like those things didn't really change. But like my sense of focus, I think more so fell into place with Into the Blue Again.
Yeah. And I think those songs and the singing.
I was more comfortable. I was older. Yeah. And, you know,
songs had singing.
Yeah. I started singing on In a Safe Place, but I only sang one song, and Paul from Blackheart came out and did that with me. And Paul basically kicked me into gear to sing. He gave me like, I don't know how many shots of vodka, and I was really loose, and they could hear it in that take. It's On Your Way. And I'm just like, it's the first time I sang on it. And it's just like, ooh, you know, I was like, like really deep voice and just didn't really know what I was doing.
Yeah.
Paul sang over the top of it. And then Into the Blue Again was when I was like, okay, I'm going to take the lead of singing and do it myself. And that was kind of, where I just kind of like felt, was much more comfortable. I knew about recording, I knew about making records, and I went to the studio and did it and kind of knew what I was doing and had like a, you know, a clear kind of,
yeah, you're comfortable.
I was comfortable. Yeah,
I feel like that's when you're gonna have the right. So you're comfortable with Sigur Rós.
Yeah, there's that making of documentary for making that record too. It's on YouTube.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is pretty cool to kind of go back and see. It's like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
so do all this kind of, all this stuff, and it was very focused, you know.
Have you saved stuff over the years? Not just gear, because I know you're got crazy amounts of gear, but like photos or tour laminates
I have a photo album from my Sigur Rós tour Sigur Rós in 2003, which is pretty fun to look back on. I know I have stashes of photos somewhere. I have a chest that's in my garage that I I know I just put things in there and I kind of don't go back to it. And I'm always curious, like, you know, to like open it up and see what's in there again.
I've made bands do it.
I don't feel like I save. I have laminates and stuff like that because laminates.
Flyers.
I remember the first time I got a laminate, I was like, "Whoa, this is big time!" You know, or the first time I made a laminate.
I can go anywhere.
Yeah, or when like Japan like treats you very well, and I do fairly well in Japan. I remember the first time going to Japan, two shows that I had a laminate. Japan album leaf tour, it was a laminate.
Serious?
Like, whoa, this is cool. You know, like super super funny. I remember when I played Radio City Music Hall, there was a specific show laminate for that.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it's radio. Album leaf was like 2-point like print. It was really funny,
but it's still on there.
Yeah, it's still on there. Like, shh,
I'll leave. So some saving, some stuff, it's all in a box. One day you'll look at it.
Yeah, I think so. My parents and my grandma used to like save clippings and stuff, like the actual like print clippings from like early Tristezza and early album lift days.
Do you have those?
I do have those.
Okay, yeah. Good,
actual print stuff. Yeah,
one day I'll make you scan them.
Yeah, because I know that you're that's you. Yeah.
You wouldn't believe the bands that I've made go through their stuff. I've got Jimmy Eat World to go through their stuff. Yeah. Do you remember a photographer, Paul Drake?
Paul Drake was my tour manager, and I mean, he was tour managing At the Drive-In during their blow up. You know,
he has like, amazing photos there. Of all those guys, yeah. And of course, you know. So I'm like, how have you not had a book? And I just think like those people, like I talked earlier about, like not the musicians, but like the tour manager or like those people. He taught so many bands.
His era too, like he started in like the Christy Front Drive era, like that whole thing. he was early Denver, you know.
Yeah,
and took off. And yeah, I remember he was our Tristezza's tour manager through
in Europe
and drove us, tour managed us when he was in Prague, would stay at his house. And he's awesome.
He's such a sweetheart.
Yeah,
you know, the connections like that, and
right,
it's almost like still reaping rewards now.
Yeah,
for your bands.
Right, totally.
And for everything you're doing. And I wanted to mention the Eastern Glow Recordings.
Yes.
Well, you started that to reissue stuff that hadn't been out or that was discontinued.
It's more stuff that was discontinued and out of print. And also being able to, I guess being able to do it too. So that was kind of the thing too. Cause I remember, so after my Sub Pop, contract was up and I was kind of, and I did an EP, it was forward return EP. And also, my first soundtrack was Towards Distraction, and I wanted to just put those out. And so I literally just pressed CDs. And so that was kind of the beginning of Eastern Glow, but it wasn't named that or thought of. I think the first official release was maybe when I got the rights for Seal Beach, which Paul Fisher put out, Paul and Dave on Holiday Mat or Better Looking. And when he gave me the rights back for that, I like pressed it up on vinyl because it had never been pressed on vinyl. So I was like, oh, cool, I can do that. And then pressed up Forward Return on vinyl, did a 7-inch. When I was kind of going to just, before I went with Relapse, I was kind of just in line to just do it myself. And so we'd pressed up a 7-inch to, because I kind of had that mentality too. It's like, oh, 7-inch. Nobody cares about 7-inches anymore, I don't think. And nobody really probably seeks out to buy them. But for me, this is just like it's a staple in my, in my vinyl upbringing, and just my discovery of things was like getting somebody 7-inch, you know? So I felt like putting a 7-inch out and making an exclusive like vinyl only song, which I think is still exclusively vinyl only. But yeah, and then starting to think about it more where like I got the, you know, One Day I'll Be on Time and Orchestrated Rise of Fall were just straight up out of print. They were just gone. And then I think somebody said that they saw it on the wall at Amoeba for like $175. And I was like, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Like I want to redo that.
Yeah.
And like have it be accessible. And like, I don't know. I mean, I know that there's a lot of the vinyl hungry and the vinyl.
No, it's fucked up. I don't care that it's this color and there's only four. I want to just play it.
Yeah. I want the music. I don't, you know, like people do like, and I know that it was like, I was a part of this guy, he has this vinyl channel called Too Many Records. And, he literally does have too many records. He just has a, you know, it's insane what he has. But his music taste is also very across the board. Like he has like all Pearl Jam's records, but then he has like all of like Aphex Twins records, you know, so his
across
taste
the board.
Is across the board. But he's all about the variants. He's all about the like this, and he's all about digging out and finding this like particular press and doing this whole thing. And then like, and I mean, yeah, there's something to be said for that for sure. But for me, yeah, I want the music and I just want the music to be accessible. That's why I was never opposed to streaming or to Napster or to any of those things. I was always a, like, I would rather people have it and be able to hear it than...
Because they're going to be more apt to go see you, go buy the t-shirt.
Exactly. That was always my statement during the Napster years was like...
Can't download a t-shirt.
Yeah. And there was like, you know, I was thinking the first time that like this couple that was in their 60s came to my show at Fireside Bowl. You know, like if you've been to the Fireside Bowl, it's a dump.
Yes, it's a dump.
You know? It's like, it's a shitty sound system. It's a dumpy room. The bowling alley.
And they
broken.
Came because of Napster?
They came because of Napster. And they stuck around. They waited. They said hi. They wanted to be like, hey, we discovered you on Napster. And I was like, there they are with their like CD and their t-shirts that they bought. And like, and I was just like, that is fucking awesome.
There's a value to that.
Yeah, there's a value to that. That's more important than being like, fuck you, pay me. Or like, you know.
Right.
Of course, pay me too, you know, like you're still putting out art,
but discovery.
You make music, but discovering, like having it there, you know,
making it easy.
Yeah,
we make it hard,
right?
We meaning music, we make it hard,
right?
It's not, it shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah, it should not be. Yeah.
I want to quickly get into the soundtrack stuff because mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting and a natural progression almost from Tristezza and Album Leaf, because you can hear those as movies,
right?
And TV.
Yeah. Which is kind of it's how it started. I think that record In a Safe Place was also the kind of the, that entire record was used on the TV show, The OC.
Oh, right.
Every single song, except for Over the Pond, probably. But every song, and also one of the songs ended up on the soundtrack for the OC. So there was like a time period where like, I don't even think I put it together that films could be scored by somebody like me.
Really?
Yeah. I never put it together. Like it never really made sense to me. Like I had a lot of success in the licensing and my songs being used for sync, but never really thought about scoring. It just didn't click. You know, I just didn't think that like,
right.
You know, I wasn't familiar even in those years. Like I wasn't familiar with like who Hans Zimmer was or who like, I think I knew who Danny Elfman was for sure, but I didn't, but also to that, I felt like, oh, that's like, you know, Danny Elfman from Oingo Boingo, and he just kind of makes, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I love Pee-wee's, you know, I love all Tim Burton, like, and it kind of felt like a pair, but I didn't really put it together that it's like, oh no, he's actually scoring and putting, you know. Anyhow, I mean, that was kind of like my mentality and outlook of it. And then like 2004 until, I mean, 2009 really. I just had a lot of like, and I still do have a fair amount of like licensing and sync usage, and it's pretty steady. But in 2009, I played this show at the Launchpad in Albuquerque. And this guy who, plays in a band called Bellini, which is a band from Sicily that Damon Che used to play drums for. But these two, Agostino and Giovanni, they're from Sicily, and they basically have this band. Short story long, basically, the bass player for that band they had gotten added to the bill of our Album Leaf show at the Launchpad, and the bass player for that band struck conversation with me, basically like on our connection that he plays in Bellini and I knew mm-hmm. them. And when I was in Blackheart, we did shows, a lot of shows with Agostino and Giovanni and Sicily and stuff like that. And basically he said, hey, my friend of mine made this documentary. It's really heavy. It's really this, you know, kind of beautiful story. She followed this girl with this really like, rare syndrome. And she used a lot of your music in the soundtrack. She wanted you to see it and see if it was cool for you to let her use your music. And I was like, oh, sure, totally. And then like gave me the DVD of the film. I sat in the van driving cross country, watching it, you know, with like my CD DVD drive, like being shaken and everything. Like, and I was like, I got to start over, you know, whatever. but like watched it. And, I think it's probably my wife or my manager or somebody of that time. That was just like, maybe you should just score it. Like just offer to score it. So I was like, okay, cool. And I know she didn't have any money. So I was like, look, can I just what about if I just score it? I'll just score it for free. Like, well, how about that? You know, I,
you're going to learn something at the same time.
Yeah. And so I had nothing going on, and that's basically how that happened. So then that happened. I scored it, and it was kind of like a lot of like, you know, I was like doing not sound likes, but obviously like following more of what she had laid in there temp wise, you know, mm-hmm. didn't really have my own voice, which is kind of why it turned into something that I could kind of release as a record, because there is like actual songs,
right.
you know, because I was following other kind of like guides of temp music that was being used. And then my wife is in film and is a filmmaker and documentary filmmaker, and she has, you know, a lot of friends and a lot of connections in the documentary world. So she kind of like was like, hey, you should look at my husband. He's like starting to
score
out.
Awesome.
And like basically kind of she like set me down the path of somebody was looking for a score for their film. As this one, the second film I did was called Wonder Woman, Untold Story of Superheroines. And it was a film about Wonder Woman, how she represents, you know, the growth of feminism and, you know, through the years, mm-hmm. and how she was as a, you know, one of the only female action heroes, dating back to the 30s, and how her role changed, you know, through the years of the growth of the feminist movement and just, you know, equality and everything. And how, so that was that film, and the filmmaker needed a, composer. And so my wife did that connection. And, so I scored that film, and that was also along the lines of like, she was a little more like, she had a Heart song and she wanted it to sound like Heart. So I made a sound like of Heart, you know, like there was that kind of thing where I was like doing a right. lot of like, you know, but also kind of slowly discovering my scoring voice within that film a little bit. And then the producer for that film was a friend of another film that was being, it's just, and it's so kind of spiraled that way. You know, turns out like the narrative films that I've scored, now, I've done three with these filmmakers, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. Justin was actually hired by Dave Brown, my old manager, to film me making Into the Blue Again.
Wow. Which is
that video that exists was shot by this guy, Justin.
So he already knew you.
And he knew me. And he, then years later, he made his first film. It was all sound design. They released it, opened at Tribeca, got traction, was like kind of a, you know, a little like, genre indie favorite,
right?
Made their second film, or started to make one. Starting to, he wrote a second film. Came to me and said, "Hey, I'd love for you to score this film." And I remembered him as the guy that I knew from San Diego who came out on tour with me, shot, you know, like filmed me and like stuff like that. It was a cool dude, but I didn't, you know, I was like, "Oh, okay, cool." And I saw his first film that he made, Resolution, and I was just blown away.
Wow!
And then, I mean, yeah, three films later. Their fourth. I've done three films now. We have our film opening this weekend in Toronto, with starring Jamie Dornan and Anthony Mackie. So it's like,
what's that one called?
Synchronic. You know, and it's just like, here we are. We've just like grown together in that world. And I still get kind of work based off films that I've done with them. And I've kind of established my own.
That's amazing.
Kind of thing. I fell into it really. And, but it was also very natural for me to do.
But the approach of it was the same as you driving to Michigan.
Right. Exactly. Totally.
So you met you're meeting the people, and then by the time you get there, it's just, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And falling into that, and then being able to do that type of music and being able to be expressive that way.
Yeah. And now I've done six films in the last year. Two of those were my wife's, and then four others. And
wow.
I was back to back to back to back. And the juggling of Album Leaf and scoring is a little tough, but it's also, you know, I'm a father. I'm older. I don't have as much interest in spending half my life on tour anymore, and it's making sense, you know. But I do want to continue Album Leaf, and I do want to like find ways to do things and make it really special and make it more of an experience rather than just coming in and seeing an Album Leaf show, you know. Like I want it to be something behind it, you know, something that's,
and then the visuals too, which I know.
Yeah.
So is that what's next, kind of juggling the scoring, because that's turning into a beast on top of the Album Leaf?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, I have things that I want to do and release, you know, with Album Leaf, and I also want, you know, the this year alone we're starting a project of basically working with modern current artists that I truly love and respect the music that they're making, and having them kind of relook at that record in a safe place and having them start new versions of those songs and working together to kind of recreate that record in a cool way, because I do want to celebrate that record. But at the same time, I personally am not really a fan of the go out and play the record front to back thing. You know, I know that fans probably appreciate that, but for me, I just want to keep it more interesting and more exciting personally. Cause also if you've seen Album Leaf in the last,
you played all those songs.
We played those songs. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not rare that we're going to play.
Yeah. It's not the deep cut.
It's not the deep. Yeah. We're going to play those songs, you know? So I want to be able to represent those songs in a cool way and have them be something that's new and fresh or facelifted or whatever it is, you know, or have somebody play somebody else's version of it, or, just kind of create like a special happening around it rather than just, here's the song, here's how it was, let's play it.
Right. You know?
So
looking at things a different way.
Yeah. I remember I played at a ATP festival in England in 2015, and that was the first time I was asked to play in a safe place. And also Max Richter was asked to play Blue Notebooks, and the Note Twist was asked to play Neon Golden, which is one of my favorite records of all time. And when I saw the way that they performed Neon Golden, that's, I think, when something clicked for me, because they didn't play it in sequence. Songs were just improvised and jammed on and everything. And you could tell that they were playing the record, but it was just, they went in so many different places. It was just
they were enjoying it.
It was a performance. It was you know, they put together a lot of thought and put together this whole thing and perform that record in a way that was, I want a recording of that as well as being able to put the record on and listen to that, you know? So that kind of changed my perspective of how to do something like that and wanting to do something different.